Welcome to Exploration 1, Module 8.
So this indeed is Exploration 1, Module 8, and, well, Lecture 8. They're not really modules, they're not actually the Module 8, it's actually Lecture this time. We're doing them subsequently in order, and then we're going to cover the various bits and pieces that we're going to get through in the course. Okay, first thing I would like to point out is that on the remote bundle, which you all should have connected to by now because you're all busy doing Chapter 2 and 3 labs in Exploration, cool. I've changed the breakback character to Control B for Bravo, so that you can now exit out of Nano. So the actual escape character, when you actually do a slash C4 or slash C5 to connect to the workstations, is now Control B for Bravo. It does tell you that as soon as you connect, but if you're having the sort of day I'm having, you probably won't read that anyway. So just keep that in mind, that character has changed, and it is no longer Control X, because you can't press Control X to get out of Nano if the escape character is Control X.
Thanks. For those of us that like Nano a whole bunch better than VI, we appreciate it.
Fair enough. There is also Joe on there, and there's also AE, which is another one that's Nano-like, but not Nano. So you do have options, and you Nano-likers will have Nano, which is good. Gemma actually has a .NanoRC, which I will send to anybody who's interested, that turns off the cursor location, the help window, and basically makes it chatter a lot less in the terminal window. So if anybody wants that, I can make that turn up for people. It's quite nifty. So, as we're saying, the editors you've got on there, in case you want to use them, you've got VI, which nobody wants to use. I heard a joke the other day, Brian will have seen it because he follows Command Line Magic, but it's like, how do you generate a random string of characters, put a new Unix student in front of VI and tell them to exit? We have ED, which is line-based. We have Nano, which is full screen and the cursor keys work most of the time, and JAWS or whatever doesn't always read what you're sitting on, but that's why you've got a Braille display or a read current line command. We have Joe, which is Joe's own editor, which is a bit like WordStar, if anybody remembers how that works. And we have AE, which is Anthony's editor, and it's a different one. So they are all your options for editing files on the Linux workstations on the remote bundle. Okay, does anybody have any questions, queries, concerns, stuff they would like to talk about before we get started on the content that I'm lecturing on today? Alright, anybody tell me how long? You either type it into chat or you can tell me. How long is an IPv4 address?
32-bit.
We have one answer from Grace, which is 32 bits. 32 bits! Anybody else want to come in with an answer? Anybody got any other ideas?
I agree.
She's correct.
Alrighty, they are 32 bits long. They are a big binary number. And obviously the most significant bit is on the left and the least significant bit is on the right. I just point that out because we should know that from our binary conversion that we have done over the last couple of weeks. You have a network portion, you have a host portion. Can anybody tell me what is the quantity that separates the network portion from the host portion? What sets the boundary? What's that thing called?
Subnet mask.
That's correct. The subnet mask has a number of ones on the left-hand side and a number of zeros on the right-hand side. Yes, this is revision. If we are writing the IP addresses in CIDR notation, which stands for classless inter-domain routing, in case you cared, you actually put slash 24, which means there are 24 bits in the network portion and 8 bits in the host portion. Is everybody cool with this so far?
So far.
Yep.
Alrighty. Remember that if we have IP addresses, say, for example, 192.168.1.0/24, we have, where's my edit box? 192.168.1.0/24. Okay, As we know, the first 24 bits of that quantity, i.e. the 192.168.1 portion, is the network portion of that address, and the 0 on the right-hand side is the host portion, that's the last 8 bits of the address. So 24 bits of that address are network, and 8 bits are host. Everybody okay with that? Alrighty, remember we said that if you have all of the bits in the host portion set to 0, so in other words, in our example, 192.168.1.0, that was the network address, and if you had them all set to 1, which is 192.168.1.255, that would be the broadcast address, which means it would go to all hosts on that particular subnet. Yep, everybody remember that? Alrighty, now, I've got a binary worksheet from Randy, which I'm going to mark today. Is everybody relatively good at the binary conversion stuff? I'm going to do a really quick rundown for the recording so that we've got it here on today's recording, and then I'm going to stop and I'm going to ask if anybody's got any questions. So, you're converting a number between 0 and 255 to binary. The first thing you do is find the largest power of 2 that is subtractable from the number. So, say for example, we are converting the number 255. We find the largest power of 2 that is subtractable. It is 128. We write a 1. We then look for the next largest power of 2, which will be 64. We write a 1. We then look for the next power of 2 and see if it is subtractable, which will be 32. We then write a 1. So obviously if we continue down through 16, 8, 4, 2 and 1, we will get the result 1111111 for the binary of 255 in decimal. If you cannot subtract a particular power of 2, you write down a 0 and then look at the next lowest power of 2 to see if that can be subtracted. That is how you convert from decimal to binary. Everybody clear with that process? I am happy to work through it, bits of it more slowly if anybody needs me to. Okie dokie, so then converting from binary back to decimal, we look at the right-hand side of the binary, the least significant bits, and we start adding the powers of 2. If the bit is set to a 1, we add the corresponding power of 2, so the right-hand column is 1, the next one across is 2, the next one is 4, the next one is 8, the next one is 16, 32, 64, 128. We add up the combination of the bits that is set to 1, and that will give us the answer in decimal of what the binary number is. Alrighty. Unfortunately, I can't lecture it that fast the first week in, but that is essentially the thing that we do. Now, it is very important that you are good at converting from binary to decimal or decimal to binary. You are not permitted to take a calculator into the CCENT exam if you choose to sit it. You are allowed pencils and bits of paper, and you are allowed to tell your reader to write things down and have your reader read things back to you. However, at this stage, you are not permitted to take in any sort of calculator. On a sidetrack, has anybody played with that new scientific calculator application for the iPhone thing?
Only the built-in one. Is there some new one that I don't know about?
Yeah, it was on Apple Viz. It's a talking scientific calculator. Apparently he's released a simple version that currently does the basic operations, but he's looking at enhancing it. I haven't looked at it yet, but I intend to. The other thing we found yesterday, which has got nothing to do with the lecture, but I'll mention it anyway because a couple of you have got eye things, is a thing called Headset by Shape Services. And you can use a thing called Mobiola Headset for your PC, and you can then turn your iPod thing into a headset microphone for your PC, and it connects to your PC via wireless network, so you can wander around the house on Ventrilo Team Talk Skype with your iThing, and it can then send it through to your PC.
Oh, I'll have to get that. That's a definite keeper. Can I ask a submitting question now?
Oh, my wordy. In fact, you're more than welcome to ask as many subnetting questions as you want. I only mentioned Mobiol headset because a couple of you have got eye things, and I have the feeling that some of you would like to sort of do lecture while sitting on the porch or something, so I thought that might be useful.
I want to go in my backyard, which I did last summer, but my Wi-Fi reaches out there, but sometimes I don't want to take the netbook. I was playing, because you posted a thing to Cavi and Out last week, about here's a cool site with practice submitting exercises. And it was all good, and then it said, if you have a network 10.101.129.183, like that's a host on address, and your subnet mask is 255.255.240.0. That's where I got stuck. I thought, okay, now I got to convert that and figure out how many host bits and network bits that has, and that's where I got a bit stuck. That, and I remember doing it before, but I could use some review on that stuff, and maybe that's where we're going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So what we do with that one, and I don't actually remember exactly the numbers that you gave me, but we'll sort of improvise.
They don't matter. It's just an example.
Yep, that's fine. So what you do is it's got a subnet mask of 255.255.240.0. Now what we have to do is we have to convert the 255.255.240 into binary. Now looking at that, I just happen to know that obviously the 255.255 is going to be 16 bits. Does anybody have a rough guess at what 240 in binary is going to be?
Three ones, 50.
Almost. It's 4 ones and 4 zeros. Because 240 is 128 plus 64, which gets you to 192, plus 16, which gets you to 224, plus 8, which gets you to 232, plus 4, which gets you to 238, plus 2, gets you to... have I added up wrong? Windows calculator.
You missed 32.
Ah. Hang on. There. Okay. 128 plus... Not 128 times. 128 plus 64 plus 32 plus 16. Yes, that adds up. 128 plus 64 plus 32 plus 16 gets us to 240. Which means we have 4 bits on the left hand side, and we have 4 and we have 1111100000. Now I could have done that with the subtraction method, but I know for a fact by looking at it that 240 has got 16 taken off the right hand side of it, and for that reason the right hand 4 bits would be set to 0. That's just something I know from experience, so that's a bit of a shortcut. So essentially what we have is we have 20 bits of network and 12 bits of host. Anybody happy with that? Anybody want me to go over bits of that? Because we are doing 12 bits of host, we can calculate the number of hosts on that network, just because it's a handy thing to be able to do, by saying 2 to the power of 12 minus 2. So 2 to the power of 12 is 4096, so we are dealing with 4094 host subnets. Anyone happy with that?
Hosts or 4094 hosts or 4094 subnets? I guess you could split it apart.
4094 hosts, because we've got 12 bits for the host portion. So to find the number of hosts on a subnet, it's 2 to the power of h minus 2, where h is the number of bits in the host portion. Because if you think about it, if we've got 8 bits of host portion, that's 2 to the power of 8 minus 2, which would be 256 minus 2 is 254 hosts. Okay, now the trick with this is to actually convert the IP address they give you into binary. And then once you've converted it into binary, you take 20 bits of it, and that is your network portion, and then the other 12 bits are the host portion. And then if you want the broadcast or network address for that particular subnet, you set the right-hand 12 bits to 0, and if you want the broadcast, you set the right-hand 12 bits to 1. You can shortcut by saying that you don't actually need to convert the left-hand 16 bits to binary because you don't actually need to mess with them. So obviously you can just convert the bits that you're actually working on, if that would make it easier for you. But it's not impossible to convert them to binary, and sometimes that's an easier way to do it. Pranav does them on a spreadsheet. How you choose to do them is up to you. If you've got a braille display handy, that tends to make life a lot easier. Otherwise, you end up with, to find the network address version of that network, you basically take the first 20 bits of the IP address they've given you, and then you set the last 12 bits to 0, and that will tell you what 10 subnet it is on. Am I making any sense at all? Or do I need to go about describing this a different way?
No, it's that makes sense. I was forgetting about the 2 to the power of h minus 2 bit, and that helps a lot. Now, hopefully, I'll go back and get that question again, and I can actually work it out before I reveal the answer and see if I get it right.
The other thing to be aware of, and I would point it out to you not during your test, but just for your handy reference, if you are in a hurry, there's an ipcalc package under Debian. I'm sure there's one under Red Hat, and there's an ipcalc command line option to Shorewall, which will do network and mask calculations and stuff for you. And for anybody else who's got a Linux box, that might be useful. However, it is to check your work, or if you're in a hurry and you're sure you've got the numbers to plug in. One of the biggest problems with subnetting is not that people shouldn't use the calculators, it's that people don't know whether an address that comes out of the calculator is actually going to be right. And then if you go and subnet your network and plug all that stuff in and find that it's wrong, you become quite an unhappy camper. So yeah, basically with that sort of question, when it's got a weird subnet mask, find out how many bits of the subnet mask are going to be... I mean, by definition, the subnet mask has got to have all ones on the left and all zeros on the right. So find out how many ones they've got. If you've got 255.255, or if you've got 255, you know you've got 8 bits. And then if you've got some weird number like 192 or... obviously, it's going to have to be a power of 2 because the bits have got to be on the right. So if you've got 192 or 240 or 224 or 128 or something, figure out how many extra bits you've got. That will tell you how many bits you've got in the network portion. You can then slice your IP address up into the number of bits on the left and the number of bits on the right, and then you can do things like 2 to the power of h minus 2 to find out how many hosts on your subnet. And then if you want the broadcast address, you put the network portion of the address down, in other words, how many bits out of the network portion, and set all the host bits to 1. And if you want the network address, you set all the bits to 0. In the host portion. That give you a little bit more to mess with?
Yeah, that's a lot clearer.
Okie dokie. Now, so the whole point is figuring out all of the things, how many hosts you can have on the network. Basically, the more subnets you have, the fewer hosts you can have. The more hosts you have, the fewer subnets you can have. So it's all about balancing up the number of subnets you need against the number of hosts per subnet. How many addresses do you lose out of any subnet? Can anybody tell me? Yes, you lose two addresses. One is the network address, where the host bits are all set to 0, and one is the broadcast address, where the host bits are all set to 1. If we are dealing with 192.168.1.0/24, 192.168.1.0 is the network portion, and 192.168.1.255 is the broadcast address. This is to say that out of 256 addresses on said subnet, you have 254 that you can use. This means that the smallest usable subnet, unless you have a point-to-point link, is a four-address subnet, which has a network address, a broadcast address, and two host addresses. And some of you may have seen this sort of subnet when ISPs used to use PPPoA with ADSL. You get a subnet mask of 255.255.255.252, and then there are four addresses on the subnet: yours, the ISP's, a network, and a broadcast. A little bit wasteful, which is why the ISPs tended to move to the PPPoE stuff, so they only have to assign you one address. It's also worth mentioning that if you are subnetting with IPv6, all of this still applies. It's just that everything gets bigger. You start having prefixes of, you've got 128 bits, so you have prefixes like /96 and /64, and it's a bit... If you have a /96 prefix in IPv6, you actually have 2 to the power of 32 addresses to use for your network devices. That is to say, you have the entire IP space of IP version 4 to use on your home network if you have a /96 prefix. If you have a /64 prefix, you can actually subnet 65,536 subnets of 2 to the power of 32 addresses. So, assigning an IP address to your toaster will not be a problem.
But don't sign a host address above 3, otherwise it will burn your toaster.
It depends if you're running on Western Australian power where the voltage is too high. Alright, so we're not actually covering IPv6 subnetting, but I'm just explaining how it works so that you've got some idea that the numbers just get longer. And you can still do the same rules and it all works pretty much the same. You've got weird things like FE80, which is the link local subnet, which hashes your MAC address into a unique address so that Windows Home Group can work without falling over. I read something, and I'm not sure whether this is true, that if you turn off IPv6, your home group busts. Anybody seen that anywhere?
No, I did turn it off, but I turned off home group as well, because it made things go slow.
Yeah, I've never used the home group.
We're having interesting problems with network speed under Windows 7. It doesn't like Linux Samba very much, and we haven't figured out why. Basically, when you push stuff to the server, it goes up at about 25 megabytes a second, and then when you pull stuff from the server, it comes down at 5. And we still haven't quite figured out why that is. This is on a gigabit network, so we're not too happy about that at the moment. Windows 7 is not our favourite networky thing.
I'm having the same kind of thing.
Thank God it's not only me. I would drive myself nuts trying to figure out why my performance to my network attached storage was so awful.
It's a Windows 7 problem, and I'm not 100% sure why it's caused. I mean, I've looked at a lot of things about messing with windowing and scaling and all this sort of you know, sacrificial goat's blood. None of it seems to have made any difference. So something fundamental. And then I read somewhere if you go into the policy editor and turn off the encryption, the 128-bit encryption, that can also help put it back into legacy mode. But if you're not running a corporate version of Windows 7, you've got to go in and do it in the registry, and it gets a bit messy. So if any of us comes up with a solution to this, we'll make sure we let the rest of us know, because it's an interesting quirk and it's quite a problem.
Is Windows XP a solution?
It actually did help. I went now, because I'm running 7 Ultimate, I could do it in sort of the advanced stuff of network and sharing, but I changed it back to, oh, what did they call it? Use standard password shares, and instead of turning on 128-bit encryption, it was a group of radio buttons, and it did help some, but it's still not what it should be on a gigabit.
Yeah, there's another one that's actually hiding in the group policy editor, and it's called, it changes the sort of use SAMBA 1 encryption as opposed to SMB 2 or something. I'll try and find the article that I found it in, and you actually have to turn it back to the legacy one, and you either do it by doing a registry hack, or you use gpedit.msc and you turn off the new style encryption, and that fixes it apparently. Okie dokie. Now, the three terms they want us to define here, sorry to digress there, but a few of us are having this problem. Unicast, broadcast, and multicast. And in fact, if you buy a cheap network-attached storage, you'll definitely have this problem, because they all generally run SAMBA, unless they're running something really odd. Unicast means that you're sending stuff to one particular address on the subnet. So, for example, you know, 192.168.16.45. Broadcast means you are sending a packet to all hosts on a particular subnet. The non-directed broadcast, which is 255.255.255.255, will send a packet to all hosts on the currently connected segment that is connected to a particular router. So this is how DHCP works. It sends its first discover packet to the non-directed broadcast address. Now, the other applications we've been playing with, just because this sort of fits in here, there's a few of them. I think there's one called Wake My PC, and there's another one where you can actually wake your PC with Twitter by DMing a particular Twitter account, and then the little agent will actually send a Wake on LAN packet to your PC and wake it up for you. So that's fun to play with if you're into that sort of thing. Wake on LAN, however, which is the ability to turn a machine on remotely by sending it either a magic packet or a particular packet to its MAC address, must be enabled in both the BIOS and the operating system. And trust me, if it's not enabled in the BIOS, it is not going to wake up your computer in the operating system. I discovered this the hard way. Alrighty, now, there are special IP addresses from 224.0.0.0 to 239.255.255.255. These are what we call multicast addresses. Now, with a multicast address, what you do is you tune in to a particular multicast group, and you can listen for traffic that is being broadcast to that particular multicast address. So say, for example, you're using Ghost or Clonezilla. I think Clonezilla supports multicast, doesn't it, Chris? Do you remember?
I think so. Well, I've never actually tried or even looked into it, but I think it might.
Wasn't that the one that Mac Daddy was recommending to you, or was that a different one?
No, that was, I think it was called Fog, F-O-G. Clonezilla is more of a standalone-based one, but I'll look into it and get back to you if you like.
Yeah, okay. A few of us here would be interested. I think you might be right. I think the other one was called Fog, but I'm not... I'll have to have a look. But there's a number of them, and they basically can use multicast to... send one copy of a workstation image out to, say, 20, 30, 40, 50 workstations. So you only see one copy of the workstation image on the wire, and then it dumps it down to all 20, 30, 40 workstations, and then you reboot them all, and they all theoretically come up and work. Alrighty, so, and you can also use it for NTP time broadcasts. You can use it for, you can broadcast NTP to the broadcast address of your subnet, or you can do it on multicast. It can also be used for getting SQUID proxy caches, SQUID proxy caches to communicate with each other over multicast. Multicast is a bit weird. The TTL on a multicast, I think one sort of says this is your local subnet, two is your country, and three is the internet or something, so it's really strange. I'd have to actually look it up. And this is an interesting, I didn't actually know this. The address block 192.0.2.0 to 192.0.2.255 is set aside for teaching, and you can use that block in documentation. So it just shows that I never do. So this is because everybody feels happy when I say 192.168.1. unless you're running on one of those silly routers that's 10. Whatever. The other thing it talks about in these notes is you've got the RAS, which are the rural address registries. You've got the Pacific one, the Asia Pacific one. You've got the American one. You've got the I think there's Japanese, there's Asia, and there's another one. And they've just recently run out of IPv4 addresses. Now, did anybody see, I think it's June 9, is National IPv6 Day, which is when all of the websites turn on their IPv6 support, like Facebook and stuff, and see how much of the internet breaks?
Yeah, I think it is June 9.
Okay, well, so basically you can, if you're interested in that sort of thing, you can have a play with it come before June 9. There are basically a couple of ways to get on IPv6. One of them is Freenet 6, or whatever they call it now. I think they've changed the name of it. It's called something else now. And you use either their client, they actually sell a network card that you just plug into your PC and all of a sudden it does IPv6. You can use 6-in-4 tunneling to get it through your regular IP address and then shuffle it out to your nearest IPv6 relay. And there are other various ways of getting IPv6 going. If anybody finds any good articles on how to get the Microsoft El Torito tunneling adapters working and talking to something other than not very much, I'd be interested to hear about it. Any questions before I continue? Any questions, comments, things that people want to add? Alrighty. Tier 1 ISPs, they are at the top of the tree, they connect to the internet backbone, they are the big ones. When a Tier 1 ISP goes down, all sorts of things stop connecting to all sorts of other things. Tier 2 provide business services, VoIP, that sort of thing. They tend to connect to Tier 1. And then you get down to Tier 3, which is your smaller ISPs and stuff like that. Now, it goes without saying, well, actually, given some of the people I've worked with, it doesn't go without saying, you really have to plan your network addressing model. You really need to plan before you go and implement it. You don't just start making up the IP addresses that you've got as you're sitting in front of the computer and go, oh yeah, 137.8.5 looks good. You really want to make sure. Now, one of the things where this actually gets a lot of people is if you're setting up, say, for example, OpenVPN or another VPN solution, and you're coming up with private IP ranges because you want to set up your VPNs on it, You may actually want to be careful what IP addresses you set up on the VPNs, because if you have all your VPNs sitting on 192.168.1. and then you have the office on 192.168.1. and then you have the home on 192.168.1. you either have to resubnet all of the VPNs, or you have to pull nasty tricks with the Linux IP remapping net filter support. And trust me, this is not fun.
I got caught at this at work, where I sort of allocated 192.168.0. I think I went from 220 to 252 as sort of addresses that could be handed out to VPN clients, because we're using that crappy Microsoft PPTP thingy, which was great until, and you know, the gateway was, once they got an IP from the PPTP, their gateway was 192.168.0.1, I think it was, which was great, except that was the same gateway in a lot of cases as their router at home, and all of a sudden no traffic went anywhere.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that until you blow it up once, you don't actually think about it too much, and then once it does blow up, you go, ooh, maybe that wasn't the best IP range to pick. So you do have to sort of pick some ranges that are going to not conflict with anything else. I would remind people, and this is actually in your final, there are reserved blocks of IP addresses, 10.0.0.0/8, 172.16.0.0 to 172.31.0. They're actually slash 16 blocks, and then you've got 192.168.x.x, and you've got 255 class C's there, and then you also have 169.254.0.0, which is your APIPA range, automatic private IP address allocation. Luckily, that question is pick the ranges of private IP addresses, pick four, and it's actually got six ranges written down, and you've got to pick the four that are actually the reserved addresses. So I'm just giving you heads up that that is one of the questions in the final.
No, but this picking ranges is really important, because I drove myself nuts, and I had all kinds of people phoning me at home panicking, saying, I connected to the VPN and now I can't do anything. And it took me a bit to sort of, because I had never done it before, to figure out why that would happen and what I had done wrong. I won't do it twice.
Absolutely. So it's very important to plan your ranges and figure out why things are going to break and how things are going to work and all that sort of good stuff. So you've got to pick a range that is out of the regular range. I would tend to go towards something like, you know, 172.16.29.something, because most things aren't going to sit around on those ranges. Or you can do what Hamachi does and go on a 5. or whatever address it is. Although, does anybody on here use Hamachi? I've heard some really good and some really bad stories about Hamachi.
I used to. When it was free, I did. Now, I think there's still a free version, but I just, you know, with things like Dropbox and stuff, the stuff that I was doing with it became irrelevant.
Okay. There's another application that I'm just going to talk about, because it's an interesting app and it's network related. It's called AeroFS, AeroFS. And it's basically like Dropbox, except it doesn't use the cloud unless you pay them. So basically you use as much space as you want to allocate on any of the particular computers. So if you want to give 20 gig to it, you can. If you want to give 40 gig to it, you can. But provided one of your computers is on and connected to the internet, you can sync your AeroFS folder from any other computer. There are clients for the Mac, there are clients for Windows, I think there's a GUI client for Linux, I'm not sure about a CLI client, I'd have to look into that, and it's far more accessible than Dropbox, so if anybody wants an invite to AeroFS, ping me at some point and I'll sort something out. It's still in alpha, but it seems quite stable, and Christopher Toth and I've been playing with it. It basically works out, even if you're not connected to the internet, it will actually use peer-to-peer networking inside your house to keep your files synchronized. It's very clever.
Well, that's brilliant. I'll send you a DM sometime. Yeah, that would be very cool. Does it sort of work behind NAT things?
Oh, yes. Certainly does. Not that I have anything against Dropbox. It's a wonderful service, and half my life is on Dropbox. I fully admit to that. But if you pay them, you know, $20 a month or $40 a month or whatever, they will give you gigs of storage in the cloud. But they do warn you that if you put your data in the cloud, there is a potential risk that you are reducing your security. And I think the AeroFS uses 128 or 256-bit ephemeral keys from end to end to actually encrypt all of your data so that people can't see what data is travelling over your connections. It's an odd shape. What was it?
It's a rubber logo.
Ah! Alrighty.
What was all that about? All we had was it was an odd shape.
It's a flash drive, and it's a rubber logo. Alright, the other thing I was going to mention was, we'll get back to what we're talking about. So watch your network ranges, basically. Be careful what you pick, and if you want to play with AeroFS, we'll sort something out. So what you do is you make sure you don't have any duplication, which we've discovered, talked about. Make sure there is no, and it also helps you fix up security problems and make sure that you're not going to have things land on other IP addresses. I once knew a guy who was busy setting up his network, and his way of finding an unused IP address was, oh, well, if you just ping it and it doesn't respond, you can drop the computer on that IP address. No, I'd prefer you pulled up your spreadsheet and tell me if that address really wasn't assigned or not, because when you turn the workstation on that was on that address that we've just allocated, all sorts of bad things, TM, will happen. You've got to make various decisions about which hosts should have public addresses and which devices should have private addresses. If the devices are having private addresses, do you need port forwards for things such as things like top speed? Very important. Things such as BitTorrent, also very important. But also things like VoIP and web servers and FTP servers and all the stuff that companies and stuff run on. Should hosts be statically or dynamically allocated? Generally, the rules for this are that if the thing is going to be a server or a printer or something that is going to be powered up for a lot of the time, you tend to statically assign it. If it's also going to have port forwards pointing at it, you will tend to statically assign it. Otherwise, the port forwards will break unless you're using universal plug and play. Otherwise, you can assign addresses dynamically. Problem with static allocations is you have to get the IP address, the subnet mask, the gateway, and the DNS servers all entered in correctly, and if somebody botches them up, things will go bad.
Now, why do they have... I've seen it on a bunch of routers. In fact, mine has a chapter on it. Reserve DHCPs, where you could actually, you know, let DHCP assign an address and then tell it, okay, when you see this, whenever you see this MAC, it wants this address. What's the point of that?
Well, the point of that is exactly for what I was talking about a second ago. If you've got port forwards that you'll, for example, need to forward top speed to your workstation, you can tell the router that the MAC address of your workstation is always going to be assigned .7, and then your router can have all the port forwards for your workstation pointing at .7, which means that if your workstation were to get a different address, it wouldn't break all the port forwards pointing at your workstation.
But then why not just assign it statically and put it outside your DHCP range and be done with it? Like, I'm missing something in this equation.
Well, there's two ways of looking at it. One is that if you statically assign the addresses on your workstation, you've got a key and all that information, which for the average user might be a bit complicated. It also means that the configuration is stored on each of the workstations individually. However, if you do it on the router centrally and tell it that this MAC maps to this IP and this MAC maps to that IP, you can leave every workstation set to automatically assign, knowing that the ones that need to be statically assigned to an IP will be statically assigned by the router, and the other ones which are dynamic will remain dynamic. And then when you back up your router configuration file, which of course we all do, you will then have all those statics backed up and stored centrally in the router. That's the theory.
Fair enough, that makes sense.
Yeah, so for example, on our network I've got a Linux box acting as the DHCP server, and in the DHCP server's configuration file I have a whole lot of MAC to machine mappings in that configuration file that map particular machines onto particular hosts. So it means that I can set every machine to assign an IP address automatically, assign DNS automatically, and have the network configurations administered from one central server. So that's how that works. The notes here say that DHCP allocates from a pool of addresses. How you set these pools up is up to you. But generally, you have a dynamic pool of addresses that you assign things from, and various criterion say which addresses you get. In fact, if you're using the Linux version of DHCPD, you can actually tell it to look at the MAC addresses that come in and assign certain ranges of addresses to certain vendors. You can have tags in the DHCP packets that come from the clients to tell it what to allocate and how. And I've got a really good book that's in print that I've yet to scan that tells you exactly how to configure Linux as DHCPD, and I really do have to scan it because I can't find the book electronically anywhere. It's the actual book that ISC recommends for DHCP, which is, not around anywhere. Okay, now, I spoke about, it says discuss subnetting and ANDing. Now, sort of going to cover this a little bit because it sort of explains how routers do their logic. Basically, when a router looks at the routing table and it's handed a destination IP address, it ANDs the destination IP address with the destination address of the route, and it then ANDs it with the subnet mask. And if what is left over matches the address that it originally, the network portion of the address that originally came in, it will then forward the packet over that particular route. So if you've got a router that's got a route to 192.168.2.0/24 in it, it will basically take 192.168.2.57. It will AND that with 255.255.255.0, which is the mask on your 192.168.2 route, and it will then compare those two numbers and see whether the packet matches that particular route. So that's basically how the ANDing stuff works. Basically, to do a binary AND, you put the two binary numbers one above the other, and you look at the bits as you work from top to bottom, and with an AND, one AND one is one. So if any of the bits are zero, you're going to get a zero, because for an AND gate to be true, you have to have both of the inputs of the gate set to one to get an output of one. With OR, either of the inputs of the gate is one, you will get a one on the output. And we don't really cover much more of that in this course, although I will check what the notes have got to say and come back and elaborate on it more next week if I need to. Okay, a couple more things to finish off on. Okie dokie, we have ping and trace route. Ping sends an echo request and it wants to get an echo reply packet back, hopefully. Windows firewall will tend to stop these. A lot of configurations actually disable ping internally to stop things on the internet from pinging you, because one of the things that script kiddies like to do is ping you and then attack you with all sorts of different exploits, and then when the pings stop, they know they've knocked your machine down or crashed your router or whatever. Speaking of network attacks, an interesting one I've seen recently is there are some attacks being launched against SIP servers like Asterisk and things like Sepuras and stuff, and we've actually had situations where weird packets have come in from the internet and crashed the Sepura and put it into La La Land. So the way to stop that is to move your Sepura or your VoIP off 5060 if you possibly can, because that's the port they tend to target.
So if I set my RTP port to something else, it will... mine hasn't crashed, but I suspect it's a matter of time.
Yeah, if you can actually set your SIP port to something other than 5060 and then make sure it registers with the provider, and then the provider will know where you are. So even if it's like 5064 or 5070 or something, you just change the SIP port and that will be less likely to be targeted. ICMP is Internet Control Message Protocol, version 4. It's responsible for sending messages such as time exceeded, which is what the traceroute protocol uses, echo request, source quench, network unreachable, and host unreachable. You find that if you are having MTU problems, which we've spoken about in the past, and you have ICMP turned off, you never ever get the don't fragment messages back, so you have no idea that your packets are too small, and that's why it can be very difficult to diagnose MTU problems unless you have a handy version of T-Shark or Wireshark. That's all we have for today. Any questions, queries, things people want to ask about before I hit the stop button?